Hi there. I'm Monica Agarwal. Nice to see you, and thank you so much to The Real Truth for having me on the show. Here are my affiliations. I am adjunct professor at the University of Florida, and I practice telemedicine and clinically in Orlando, Florida. The name of my talk today is How My Daughter Saved Me, My Journey to Better Health. So why am I here? Well, I'm a preventive cardiologist. I focus on advanced lipid management. I take care of people who have complex heart disease. I also take care of people who don't have heart disease and who are focused on improving their health. I'm also a researcher. I do a lot of work in nutrition and lifestyle, trying to understand how nutrition impacts chronic illness and specifically heart disease. I'm also a mom. I have three children. I had three children within 4 years. I'm an athlete. I'm an active runner. I consider myself a yogi, although I don't know if other people do. And I'm also a triathlete. But I'm also a patient. It's been about 11 years now since I was diagnosed with an inflammatory arthritis. It started out with inflammatory joints and migrated around my body. And at that time, I was stubborn and ignored my symptoms and treated myself for Lyme disease, didn't get better and continued to get worse and was diagnosed with inflammatory rheumatoid arthritis. I was told I had an overall very bad prognosis because my numbers were extremely elevated and I was highly inflamed. I was told to get on medications within a week of my diagnosis, which required me to stop nursing my third child at 4.5 months postpartum. This is probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. There they are today as they've grown up. Even this is a little bit old, of an older picture. There I am as a triathlete, and I'll explain how all this evolved. So I was diagnosed with advanced rheumatoid arthritis. I had all of the classic symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis when I was diagnosed. I was put on medications like the ones here. Methotrexate made my hair fall out, gave me a metallic taste in my mouth. People used to say how amazing it was that I'd lost all my baby weight, but I lost it because I just couldn't eat. I was scared all of the time, emotional, fragile, unable to understand how it happened. I used to feel not in control and just angry at my kid for having gotten sick. I spent a lot of time talking to people. I took the medications though, and I got better. Within several weeks of starting the medications, though I had loads of side effects, I did get better. My joints got better. And then I went back to normal life. At one moment, about 4 or 5 months after my diagnosis, I met a woman who was a nutrition consultant. And she started asking me questions about my health and asking me if I would like her to do a screen of my health. And I thought, oh, I'm so healthy. I don't really need anything. Ironically, I thought I was so healthy. But she's the first person who started asking me and making me think about the role of your lifestyle in terms of your health. She made me consider about my nutrition, about if I was sleeping enough, if my diet could be affecting my health. I was already vegetarian, so how could I do better? She started asking me about my time and about whether I was interested in changing my nutrition to see if I could get better. It made me think about the choices I was making. The first time I was actually feeling hope because the rheumatologist for sure didn't give me any of that. I started feeling empowered and made me start thinking that maybe could I actually get off of the medications. I was told by my rheumatologist that I would never get off of medications and that I'd be on medications for the rest of my life and that I had an incurable illness. So I thought, what do I have to lose? I was at a fork in the road and I decided to think about what I was willing to do to get better. And think about what if it didn't work and what if I got worse, all those choices and those scary feelings that come at the time of severe illness. I decided to take a leap of faith. I was already vegetarian and I started eliminating foods that I thought were, and started learning about that were inflammatory, started adding back healthy foods, working on sleep and activity and yoga. I started feeling better within weeks. I went on to becoming an active yogi. There I am in some of my best days of yoga. I went on to become a triathlete, and I stopped my medications about 10 and a half years ago. I'm 11 years after diagnosis, about 10 and a half years with lifestyle changes, and I've been off of medication, for 9 years, and I'm not looking back. So what does this story tell you about life, health, inflammation? It taught me that lifestyle actually does work, that there's so many things you can do in your diet and your lifestyle that can help you and change your body. The diet can change your body. So I moved out of my private practice. I wrote a book to honor my daughter, who I thought was to blame for me getting sick. And I shifted my entire career. So the reason I tell you this story is that I'm not alone in that illness story or the doctor-patient story, but mostly to remind you that all of us as doctors have also had illness. And sometimes it's those times of illness that we have to really try to lean on what we know. And as a doctor, I felt lost because while I've trained for more of my life than I haven't trained, I didn't have any information on how to treat myself from this quote unquote incurable illness that I would be on medications for the rest of my life, other than the medications. I was never taught how to eat. I was never taught how to heal my body with lifestyle techniques. And so it took me years of time after my diagnosis to learn how to heal my body. And it's for this reason that I think these talks are very important, so that the community can be aware of how they themselves can heal your body. It's not that everybody can get off of medication or that that's the end goal. The end goal should be healthy quality life, good quality of life, feeling strong, invigorated. And if you can come off of medication or reduce medication, you consider yourself one of the lucky ones. So let's go down this rabbit hole a little bit and figure out and understand some of the background. So the top 10 causes of death in the United States are largely preventable. Number one, heart disease being the number one cause of death in the United States and around the world. All of these illnesses, though, I think are bound by a fundamental unifying pole in the middle, which is inflammation. While you may not have the same genetic code or risk, the inflammation often is the trigger. What does that mean? Well, what is inflammation? Well, inflammation, I always tell people, is your body's mad at you. Something you're doing to your body is irritating it. So the traditional thought is that you have a genetic predisposition to disease, meaning you have your genetic code says that you are going to have this illness. Well, you can't change your parents, or you can't change that code necessarily. And that you have some sort of second hit, and that second hit activates the code and causes expression of the illness. And then that illness causes inflammation. And our standard thought is that we then treat the illness and we treat the inflammation. But another way to look at it is to consider that you have this genetic predisposition. I was predisposed to getting rheumatoid arthritis, and that we have lifestyle, which is that second hit. And that is what triggers the inflammation, which can then trigger illness. And maybe that it's the inflammation that triggers the activation of the illness. So a lot of people are working in the space of epigenetics, which is really the milieu around the gene, which then maybe is the trigger for how and when genes are expressed. If you then look at it this way, then if you use treatments to treat lifestyle and to treat inflammation, then you should be able to trigger the illness, to suppress potentially the illness, and maybe you'll never get it or you'll have a milder form. Well, inflammation, I always tell people, again, is when your body's mad at you, so that there's an imbalance between the stresses in your life and the imbalances or resources in your life. And when there's an imbalance, then you develop inflammation. Well, there are a lot of stresses in our life, things like poor sleep, mental health, mental stress, water pollutants, processed foods, a sedentary lifestyle, environmental toxins. These are all things that we do to our body, or our body's exposed to on a daily basis. In the time of COVID, we're seeing a lot of people with low sleep and high levels of mental stress and a very sedentary lifestyle and poor diet. But it's not that these are the only things. We have loads of resources in our toolkit. We have things like exercise and yoga. We have clean water. We have meditation. We have restorative sleep. And we have plant-based eating. If you consider your phone, and when you when your phone is at 7%, you run and you go and find a charger and you charge your phone. But what we've forgotten to do, and we've lost the ability almost to do, is we've forgotten how to recharge ourselves. We've forgotten how to use the resources in our toolkit to heal our bodies. So even though we take care of our phones so nicely, we've forgotten how to take care of ourselves. You might ask yourself, what do you do to allow yourself to recover? Do you eat well? Do you sleep? Do you take time to sleep? Do you take your time to meditate? Do you take time to exercise? Or is it one of those situations where you'll get to it later, which is what happened to me. I spent so much time trying to get better, progress in my career, take care of my kids, focus on so many other things that I forgot to focus on myself. So why did I get rheumatoid arthritis? Well, I had the genes, but then I had an abnormal lifestyle, a poor lifestyle, and that triggered inflammation and that triggered my illness. The genes were always there, but the lifestyle triggered the inflammation and triggered the illness. For me, my triggers were that I was sleeping about 4 hours a night because I had 3 children under 4 years old. I was working as a full-time cardiologist. While I was pureeing baby food and sweet potatoes for my babies, I would pick up a pretzel and a Diet Coke for myself. I would try to exercise and run because I'm a runner, but I wouldn't take time to sleep. So much of the time our focus is on exercise and doing. But then again, we forget to take time to sleep and calm our bodies, which is super, super important. The other inflammatory trigger that I think was significant for me was dairy. So let's consider inflammation and adding in a diet component. So if inflammation will trigger illness, well, what is the mechanism for inflammation? Well, there's loads of mechanisms, as I mentioned, about so many demands and not resources. But how does diet affect inflammation? Like, how does that even work? Well, a lot of that is related to the gut, and what you eat then goes into your gut, which then triggers inflammation, which then triggers illness. So I was laughing. My kids love this slide because they can't believe I put a poop slide in my slide set, but it is really about the poo. So just a little bit of information about the gut. I'm no gastroenterologist, and so I like things really simple. I'm a heart doctor, so I like things simple, and we leave the hard stuff to the gastro docs. So let's just do a little bit of, from the cardiologist perspective, of the gut. So you have this thing called the gut biota or the microbiota, which is all these bacteria you have and viruses and you have all over your body, really on anything that's exposed to this, to the outside world. So all of your skin and but even your body parts that are exposed, like your vagina and your rectum, all have bacteria in them and around them. And so if you think about that, that's like 100 trillion cells that are not on your, that are on your body or around your body that are actually not even human. So some people laugh and say that you're really only 10% human and the rest of you is bugs. And if you think about that and you think about the bugs, well, each of these bugs carries their own genetic material too, right? So that genetic material then actually is on your body and in your gut, and has a role in how your body, it's not in its own little vacuum. They all that genetic material and all those bacteria play a role in your general health. So some people call that microbiome your second genome or your second brain, because they have such an impact on how you do. Gut bugs can affect how you feel. What's interesting about those gut bugs is they change all the time. So if you're born by vaginal delivery, then you're going to have bugs in your, the baby's going to have the same gut bugs as the mom's vagina. But if you're born by cesarean section, the baby's going to have the same gut bugs as the skin of the mom. So that's so cool. And just thinking about sort of how the bugs are different in the child based on how they're born. But then it also changes based on if they're fed breast milk or formula, if they get a fever, if they get rice cereal, when they get it, if they get antibiotics for an ear infection, all those things are going to affect the flora of the baby. In animal studies, we also know that if you eat different foods, then you're going to have different bugs. And this is really the meat of it, so to speak. Ironic, maybe it's the kale of it. So I'm a pretty simplistic doc. So if I think about it, I think that there's loads and loads of classes of bugs in the gut, but some of the ones that seem to be families of bugs that seem to have some importance are things called Prevotella and Firmicutes. Well, what's interesting about these bugs is that if you eat like a high fat Western diet, then you're going to have low levels of Prevotella, but you're going to have a high level of Firmicutes. But if you cut out fat or cut out some simple carbs, then you actually get better. We get more Prevotella and you get less Firmicutes. Okay, well, who cares, right? If you increase fiber, then you also get more Prevotella and you get less Firmicutes. If you get gastric bypass, then you get more Prevotella and less Firmicutes. Again, who cares? Well, we also know that people who have more Prevotella actually have less gut inflammation and they have less cancer and less obesity. So there was a study that was done that looked at Africans and African Americans. So before I get to that, let's talk a little bit about the Prevotella. Let's go through that. Sorry. So we know there was a study done on Africans versus African Americans. This is sort of interesting. So they looked at the bacteria of people who are eating an African diet. So these are people who are eating the village diet, who had meat once in a while when they could get it, but primarily ate plants. And they found that that community of people had more Prevotella. So they found that Prevotella is more common in a non-Western agrarian or farmer style diet. And then they found in the African Americans that they have more of the Bacteroides, which is more common in a Western diet. One other thing that you should know is that all bacteria create short-chain fatty acids. Well, short-chain fatty acids are important because they're anti-inflammatory and anti-neoplastic. So we really want those. Anti-neoplastic means anti-cancer causing. So if you have more short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, that's actually anti-inflammatory. That's a good thing. And we also know that farmer type societies or village diets or more plant-based diets are societies that actually have more butyrate. So the societies that have a more of a plant-based farmer plant diet versus they're the ones that are more likely to have Prevotella, but they're also also more likely to have higher amounts of short chain fatty acids, which are then anti-inflammatory. So due to two different spaces that we see change at the level of the type of bacteria that we're seeing and in what the bacteria produce, which are those short chain fatty acids. We also know that the communities that eat more of a standard American diet have more Bacteroides, and they actually have less of those short chain fatty acids. So in that African American and African diet group, what they did was they looked also at their colons. And they said, okay, well, let's look at the people who are eating the standard American diet, and let's look at the people who are eating the village diet. And the people that were eating the standard American diet had polyps. They had 20 Americans had polyps. And interestingly, in the Africans or the South Africans, they actually had no polyps. And so you could say, well, who cares? Because that could just be genetic. Genetic South Africans who live in the village, they're just genetically not going to have colon polyps. So what they did in the study was they actually changed their diets. And what they did was they gave them, let's go back for 1 second, I forgot about this slide. When they looked at the amount of short chain fatty acids in those communities, remember there's the bacteria type and then there's what the bacteria produce, which is the short chain fatty acids. they found that the NA or the Native Africans versus the African Americans, if you look at the black, there's the African Americans, and all of these are short chain fatty acids. And what they found was that the Native Americans, I mean, sorry, Native Africans had loads more short chain fatty acids than the African Americans. So what happens when they change their diets? Because they said, you know what, you know, maybe this genetic thing isn't the thing and it's actually the diet. Well, what they found was when the African Americans moved to the African diet, they had less colon inflammation. A lot of the chemical signals that suggest inflammation had reduced. And they found that the societies that moved to the more African diet started creating more short chain fatty acids. Again, those anti-inflammatory, anti-neoplastic compounds. And those that were on the African diet and went to the Western diet, they started developing more inflammation, and their short chain fatty acids actually went down. And how soon did that happen? Did that happen in months, years? Did it take years for them to change their gut or the inflammatory compounds? Well, within 2 weeks, there was a significant change in the amount of inflammation in their body. So the food that you eat can affect not only the gut bugs, which change, it changes the short chain fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory, and reduces those. And it does that within weeks. You could change your inflammation in your gut within weeks. Another example of how food affects the gut is transmethylamine N-oxide. And this is one of the best journals we have in medicine, which is the New England Journal of Medicine. And this was in 2013. And Stan Hazen at the Cleveland Clinic discovered this compound or this metabolite, which is created by the intestine. So when you actually eat foods that are high in dietary phosphatidylcholine, like cheese, red meat, and eggs, and you put them into your body and it goes into your gut, you create trimethylamine, which then goes into your liver and makes trimethylamine N-oxide, which has actually been found to create abnormal cholesterol metabolism, causes inflammation of the vascular bed, so vascular meaning blood vessels, and actually has been shown to cause plaque in the heart. So what they did in their study at the Cleveland Clinic is they started giving people, vegans, non and omnivores, they gave them radio injected dietary phosphatidylcholine. So basically they gave them cheese, eggs, and meat, and they may had them eat it, and they followed it to see what would happen. And then they measured the trimethylamine N-oxide in their body. And what they found was, if you look at this, this is myocardial infarction, which is heart attack. So heart attack, stroke, or death on the y-axis, and years on the x-axis. And TMAO, that's that trimethylamine N-oxide. And the people who had the highest amount of trimethylamine N-oxide, which is quartile four, they actually had the highest amounts of heart attack, stroke, or death. Now, that doesn't mean it's causative. It doesn't mean that if you eat those foods, you trigger those things. We can't say that, and we don't know that yet. But what we do know is that it does seem to be a marker that if you have high levels of trimethylamine N-oxide, that you are at higher risk of heart attack, stroke, and death. In animal models, we looked at trimethylamine and carnitine. And what we found was that people who ate excess amounts of dietary carnitine, which comes from animal products, it accelerates atherosclerosis. So you get more plaque in your heart arteries when you eat more dietary carnitine. Interestingly, antibiotics inhibit this effect, and that's important because it makes you realize how that antibiotics, remember, they deplete or change the gut flora. And when you do that, you actually decrease your atherosclerosis. What was most interesting to me is this slide, because what they did was they measured the blood work to see how soon the trimethylamine N-oxide increased. And here's the omnivore. And what you'll see is that within less than 12 hours, here's hours of time, you will see that the omnivore had increase in their trimethylamine N-oxide. Whoo, right up there. What's also interesting is that the vegan and vegetarian, which I'm not 100% sure how they got a vegan vegetarian to eat a steak, but they did. And when they did that, they were able to show that the vegan vegetarian had almost no change in their trimethylamine N-oxide. What that tells me and tells us is that there's likely something different about the body of the vegan vegetarian than the omnivore. And that again comes back to that gut, because if you don't have the same gut bugs as an omnivore, then you're going to have different inflammatory reactions. Another example of the gut and the metabolites that the gut makes is this thing called endotoxin. Well, endotoxin just basically means when the bacteria die, they release this thing called endotoxin or lipopolysaccharide, and it goes into the blood and it's highly inflammatory. And it's been associated with heart disease, rheumatoid arthritis, obesity, type 2 diabetes. And what we found was that people who eat high fat, high carb diets are more likely to have more endotoxin. And people who go through gastric bypass or increase their fruit and vegetable compounds or eat more fiber, they have less endotoxin or less lipopolysaccharide. Just another example of how your gut, what you eat, affects your gut. And that creates another compound, which then can cause inflammation. So what am I, why am I as a cardiologist talking to you all about this gut stuff? Well, just to remind you that bugs are all over you. You're made of a load of bugs, and they change from birth, how you're born. But that's not even the biggest part of it. It's really that you change your diet, you add antibiotics, you do different things in your life, and it creates changes in your bugs. And those bug changes can happen within weeks. But it's not just the bugs, it's what the bugs produce. Because the bugs can produce these short chain fatty acids, and they produce endotoxin and trimethylamine and oxide. And all of those things that the bugs produce can then also affect inflammation. So understanding that different foods affect your gut flora, and those gut flora changes can then decrease or affect and change that what the gut bugs make, is very important. So that's my gut blurb, because I want you to understand about why, or the mechanism that we think that food affects inflammation. So why do we care? You know, what's so wrong with the diet of the American? Like, who cares? Well, is it even that bad? I mean, come on. So if you look at the state of US health, and this is 2013, but it was re-updated in 2016, which showed that if this is the leading causes of death or the risk factors for death, you see that dietary risk is actually the number one cause of increased mortality. And that's associated primarily with heart disease. But what's wrong with our diet? Like, it looks okay to me. Well, our diet primarily is high in red meat, refined grains and processed foods. It's high in fat and dairy. Lots of desserts. Every meal has a dessert, high sugar drinks, eggs. 75% of the packaged foods in the United States now contains added sugar, and much of that comes from consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. If you look at this, people don't realize how much sugar is in their food, and specifically kids love this naked drink. People like this naked drink because the naked drink is so healthy. Well, there's actually 60 grams of sugar in a naked drink. Makes you think about sort of the amount of sugar that you're taking in your body, or maybe the iced coffee bottle that you're getting from Starbucks, 31 grams of sugar. The other way things have changed is the food has changed from the size. We're just eating so much food. Some people will say, well, I just eat healthy food. Well, we're eating too much food for our bodies, another problem. So in 1950, the normal serving of a burger was actually 3.9 ounces. But now a burger is actually 12 ounces. The soda used to be 7 ounces, and now the soda is 42 ounces. So it's not only that the food is not good for us, but that the amount of that bad food has also increased, which is another big problem. So with that, the obesity rates have skyrocketed. And now our children look less like the child on the left and more like the child on the right. With those obesity rates, we're also seeing significant increases in all risk factors for heart disease. So according to the 2017 guidelines for high blood pressure, you can see here that now 45.6% of Americans have high blood pressure. So half of Americans now are diagnosed with high blood pressure. 10.5% of Americans have diabetes, although, and 21% of those Americans are undiagnosed. 27% of Americans over 65 have diabetes. 35% in addition have prediabetes. 12% of Americans actually have high cholesterol, and 70% of Americans are overweight or obese, 70%. Well, there's many risk factors for heart disease. There's high blood pressure and there's smoking, but they're broken down into modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. So the non-modifiable risk factors are things you can't change, like age or gender. or your genetic factors like your parents or your race or ethnicity. Certain races like Southeast Asians are more likely to have heart disease. You can't change those. Those are non-modifiable risk factors. But what can you change? I mean, look, this is a larger part of what you can change. What you can change: your blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, physical activity, obesity, high cholesterol. These are all risk factors for heart disease, and they are modifiable. So this is a blood vessel, and this is simplistic. So this is my territory. So, but I do still like things simple, but I just want to explain to you a little bit about heart disease. So if this is the blood vessel, and you can imagine that the blood goes through the center of this pipe, then you can see that then it starts out really, really small. And that's the thing about heart disease, is that people call it the silent killer. Well, if you start looking at heart disease, you can see that it starts out really at the top of this cartoon. You can see that it starts out with very minimal changes in what we call the endothelium, or the lining of the cells that is closest to the blood flow. And those become abnormal because of high blood pressure or high cholesterol. And we can see that as early as the first decade of life. And then over time, with you've developed more cholesterol or lipid deposits inside your heart vessels, which we call fatty streaks, and they build up further to sort of plaque formation. And then we call it full-on atheroma, which is truly a full plaque with a fibrous cap. And then you can get a complex lesion here at the bottom, and that's over time. But, you know, we're seeing heart disease at younger and younger ages. We used to say, well, you probably wouldn't have plaque until your 30s and really not complex lesions until your 40s and 50s. But we put stents in a 29-year-old recently who had a massive heart attack. And what you can see is that it's not that we can say to people, oh, you know, this kid is young, your kids are young, don't worry, they can worry about this later. Well, is that really true? As I showed you from the last slide, that you start building up those fatty streaks even when you're very young. In fact, when we did autopsies on children who died at young ages from cancer or who died in Vietnam or Korea, you could see that people, and this is plaque and prevalence of plaque, that you can already start seeing plaque in the heart arteries, coronary arteries, and in the aorta, which is the main pipe that leaves the heart. You can see that even in 2 to 15-year-olds. Certainly rises over time, but you're seeing plaque at very young ages. All right, well, I've told you so many different things. I've told you that I got sick and sickness sucks. I also told you that I use my lifestyle to change and get better. And then I went into the bugs of the gut, and I said that I think the mechanism for diet, so that I told you that there's an imbalance often in our bodies between what we do for stresses and resources. We put too much stress on our body with the things we do with our lifestyle, but we don't do enough to do with our resources, with all our changes we can make. And then I went into the mechanism where I think that the diet affects the gut because it changes the gut bugs. It changes what the gut bugs produce. And then I sort of have talked to you a little bit about heart disease and said, okay, well, heart disease is another, was one of those largely preventable chronic illnesses, and that heart disease builds up over time. And then we talked about the way we eat in America and how we eat in America is highly refined, low fiber. Well, so what? How does that all connect? Like, so I eat poor food. You're saying that the American diet's poor food and that people are getting heart disease earlier and we're getting more obese. But if I change that, does it really work? Does it actually do anything to my heart disease risk? Well, let's take a look at this very important slide. Well, so here we have on the x-axis, we have genetic risk. So we have here low, intermediate, and high. And then on the y-axis, we have calcium. So if you look here, you can see that they have blue favorable lifestyle and red unfavorable lifestyle. So if you look at somebody who has low genetic risk, meaning they have low risk from their parents, well, they have a good lifestyle, they may get a calcium score over their lifetime of about 15. Well, if you have a low genetic risk and a poor lifestyle, then you will build up calcium. You will double your risk of getting calcium in your heart, 31. But let's go to the other side, which is really impactful. So what if you have high genetic risk? There are so many people that say, well, you know, my dad had a heart attack at 45. I'm just expecting to have a heart attack. Well, is that really true? Do you have to expect that? Well, so you have that high genetic risk and you have an unfavorable lifestyle. You have maybe that calcium of about 64. But what if that same high genetic risk person has a good or favorable lifestyle? Well, you can reduce your calcium by half, 50%. you'll see. So does lifestyle matter? Does changing your lifestyle matter? If I haven't convinced you yet, this slide should convince you, because when you have a high genetic risk and a favorable lifestyle, you can reduce the amount of calcium in your heart, which is plaque formation, by 50%. You can also look at components of the diet, and you can look at death on the y, on the x-axis here, and on the y-axis, different factors in the diet, and you can associate it with deaths. You can see here that high amounts of sodium, low nuts intake, high processed meats are all associated with increased rates of death. So what you put into your body matters. Heck yeah. So is there one component of our diet that's worse than the others? Like, what should I focus on? So let's talk a little bit about simple sugars and complex carbs. So we know that if you, the amount of calories that you get from added sugar is associated with hazard ratio, which is the increased risk of events. So if you look here in calories from added sugar here, you can see that as you increase calories from sugar, you're actually at higher rates of events. But what's more important here is that when you look at glycemic load and CHD, which is heart disease, you can see, and this is a dietary glycemic load and glycemic index and stroke and heart disease, you can see that when you increase your glycemic load and glycemic index, you increase your rates of heart disease and stroke. Let's talk about what that means. Well, glycemic index is how quickly the sugar, the insulin is activated. So if you eat a food that has a high glycemic index, then your food, it's usually very refined and easy to break down, and your insulin level is activated very quickly. And so you have this sugar, people always talk about the sugar rush, and then it goes down very quickly because your body's able to metabolize that very quickly, activates insulin, it goes up, and then it goes back down. Versus foods that have a low glycemic index are foods that are metabolized slowly, like lentils or legumes and a lot of complex carbs. Well, they make you feel really full and they don't activate your insulin levels very quickly. So you have this slow increase of insulin very slowly over time. And then, and you don't have that big upsurge and then down. Well, when you look at body mass index, so that's your weight, and glycemic load, which is your sugars, and then risk of events or heart disease rates, so relative risk of heart disease related to body mass. This is super cool and interesting to look at, because what it shows is that even if you have a low BMI, because so many people are like, well, I'm so thin, I can eat this way. Well, when you have a low BMI, that's true that you have less risk. But even with a low BMI, if you eat more of a glycemic load, so tertile 3 being the highest amount of sugars, you're eating more sugars, you're going to increase your risk of events. Certainly with the higher the BMI or the heavier you are, the glycemic load plays more of a role. But we can't ignore the fact that even when you have a good body mass index, that you still have an impact from the amount of sugar that you're taking in. So all sugar's bad. Well, no, absolutely. So there's complex carbohydrates and refined carbohydrates. In general, we want to focus on eating foods that are not, that do not have a high glycemic index. And all of the refined foods in our, that are around, mostly 3/4 of the grocery store, are going to be refined carbohydrates. They're going to be highly processed. And why are they so processed? Like, why do we do that? Well, people like eating foods where they don't have to chew so much. People like eating foods that their bodies don't have to work as hard. And they like eating foods that give them that sugar rush. So they like that sweet taste immediately. And so that's why the 3/4 of the grocery store has those refined carbohydrates in there. But those foods have a high glycemic index. They activate insulin quickly. They give you that sugar rush, and they are worse for you in terms of heart disease risk, stroke, obesity, everything you can think of, you name it. Whereas the complex carbohydrate is not the enemy. The complex carbohydrate makes you feel full for longer. It's loaded in fiber. It doesn't activate your insulin as quickly. It doesn't, and it goes that slow path. So it makes you feel full and it doesn't activate insulin and give you those sugar rushes. So we really want to be eating those complex carbohydrates, foods like green leafy vegetables, berries, potatoes, but mostly just greens. I always tell people, but also whole wheat breads and millets and spelt. Those are good complex carbohydrates, but really don't want to be eating foods that are like sugar sweetened beverages, cookies and cakes. Now, it doesn't mean that you can never, ever have those foods. No. But should you almost not have those foods? Yeah. According to the American Heart Association, the max, and are some people argue that this is even too much, that the maximum amount of sugar that a person should eat based on gender is for a woman no more than 6 teaspoons, and for a man no more than 9. So 36 grams for a man and 25 grams for a woman. That's the daily limit. And remember that in that naked drink, when I showed you those sugar sweetened beverages picture, the naked drink or that sugared shake, naked shake, had 60 grams of sugar. That's 3 times more or 2 times for a man than you should be having for the entire day. But what about Starbucks? Because they would never serve food like that, right? Or they wouldn't make, you know, that wouldn't be unhealthy, right? It's just coffee. Well, some people forget so much of what you do to coffee. Coffee itself is not bad for you. In fact, there's studies that show that coffee has anti-inflammatory effects. And if you eat a certain amount, it's actually good for you if you drink a certain amount. But what we've done to coffee is we kind of destroyed it because we add so much sugar and cream to make it more palatable, quote unquote. So if you get the 16-ounce coffee from Starbucks, it's so beautifully written. It's the black tea infused. Oh, this is the tea. Sorry, the black tea infused with cinnamon, clove, and other warming spices. It's combined with steamed milk and topped with foam for the perfect balance of sweet and spicy. Who wouldn't want to have that? Well, and that's, so is that so bad for you? Come on, Monica, what are you talking about? So if you look at it, and that's 16 ounces of tea, it's 240 calories. So people look at that and say, well, that's not very many calories. Okay, well, how much sugar is in that? Well, if you look down and go all the way down, you get 42 grams of sugars. And if you notice that there, the dietary fiber is zero, which means that there's no complexity to those sugars. Those are just simple sugars, and you're getting 42 grams of simple sugars in one coffee or one tea. And remember, that's goal for the daily limit is 25 grams for a woman and 36 grams for a man. In one tea, you're getting 42 grams. Let's shift away from sugars and talk a little bit about fat, one of my favorite topics. Well, fats can be broken into saturated fat, unsaturated fat, and trans fats. People think, oh, that the FDA has banned trans fats, but unfortunately, very small amounts can still be in our foods, and they are still present. So we'll talk about them. So saturated fats is what we'll talk about first. And so a lot of people think about saturated fat and have looked at the recent, there's been recent studies that say actually saturated fat is not bad. What are you talking about? This is an older study in 2014, Time magazine said, eat butter. Scientists label fat the enemy. Why they were wrong. Well, are they wrong? Are scientists just dumb? So what do we know? Well, we've had 30 years of data that show that eating high amounts of saturated fat will increase your risk of heart disease. So the owing to similar associations and high correlations among individual saturated fats, dietary recommendations for the prevention of heart disease should focus on replacing saturated fat with more healthy sources of energy. We have studies upon studies that show that if you switch saturated fat to unsaturated fat, you make people better. So let's look at this. This is multiple studies here, different ones that just called by their name of the study. And then this is the unity line in the middle. And we want to be on the left side of the unity line. That means reduce risk. So when you switch saturated fat to unsaturated fat, you decrease risk. So should you switch away from saturated fat into unsaturated fat? Yes. Or should you eat butter? No. This is a great slide and one that I use a lot because it shows fats and itch on the x-axis and changes in mortality. So if you're going to die. So we want to stay below the zero because that means we reduce risk. So there's the zero right there in the middle. And so we want to stay below the zero. So if you eat trans fats, you can see that you increase your mortality. If you eat saturated fat, you increase your mortality. But if you eat monounsaturated fat and polyunsaturated fat, you decrease mortality. So why do people say that you should eat butter and that scientists are wrong? Well, it's because it's all about what you replace it with. So if you eat saturated fat, like the foods on the left, and then you replace it with this highly refined, no fiber pasta meal covered in cheese and a little bit of green to make it feel like it's healthy, then you are going to make the person worse. But if you change that saturated fat, which is the food on the left, and you move it to maybe that chickpea dish on the right with lots of veggies and some seeds in it, you're going to make people better. So it's not that saturated fat is good. Saturated fat is absolutely not good for you. But it's that what you replace it with. If you replace saturated fat with refined carbohydrates, simple sugars, and no fiber, you're going to make people worse. So arguably worse than saturated fat is that refined carbohydrate and simple sugar. And carbohydrates are not the enemy. If you look at the study from one of our another big, barely big journal called Lancet, you can see that this is hazard ratio of events. So this is mortality here on the y-axis, so risk of dying. And this is carbohydrates on the x-axis. You can see that when you have a very high amount of carbohydrates, yeah, you increase event rate. You do, because most of the time those people are eating highly refined carbohydrates. But when you also eat too few carbohydrates, here at the 20% mark, and there's people who are often eating a very low carbohydrate ketogenic style diet, those people also have a higher rate of events. So it's very important to realize that carbohydrates are not the enemy, but that the type of carbohydrate you eat has to be considered. And the goal is to get about 50 to 55% of your energy from carbohydrates. Those should be complex carbohydrates, similar to the foods here on the right, and not simple carbohydrates, which are the ones on the left. So saturated fat, where do you get saturated fat? Well, you get saturated fat from all animal products except for eggs. And you get also saturated fat from some plant products. Certain oils have saturated fat, specifically coconut oil is high in saturated fat. In fact, it's almost all saturated fat. But things like avocado also have saturated fat. So it's not that plant foods don't have saturated fat, but relative to the animal products, which have loads of saturated fat, and I'll show you another slide in a moment, the plant products have much fewer. What's a trans fat? Well, that's the most dangerous fat of all, because it increases your LDL or your bad cholesterol, and it decreases the HDL or your good cholesterol. And it is pro-inflammatory, so it triggers inflammation, and it's been associated with increased rates of diabetes, high blood pressure, stroke, and heart disease. Well, there's been a significant decline and an FDA ban to cut out trans fats, but unfortunately you can still have trans fats in your diet, in foods, if they were made before a certain date and if they're below a certain amount. So it's very important to look for foods that say partially hydrogenated. If something says partially hydrogenated, then you want to remove it from you do not want to pick up that food. And most of the foods above are going to have that partially hydrogenated trans fat. Why do we use trans fats? Well, back in the 70s, when we said that saturated fat was bad for you, restaurants were really in a trouble because unsaturated fats, which are the healthier fats, don't have a long shelf life. So foods don't last as long. So how does a restaurant survive when they need to keep foods for days and days or hours and hours? They can't last if you use unsaturated fat versus saturated. When they used to have lard, you could leave lard on the kitchen counter and it never went bad. But if you have an unsaturated fat, it would go bad. So we created trans fats. We did that because we wanted to create a unsaturated fat that lasts longer. So we created this in a chemistry lab and we hydrogenated our unsaturated fats to make things last longer. And with that, we created one of the worst fats, or the worst fat that we've ever had in our world. And then we exported it to the rest of the world. So specifically animal fats, I wanted to talk about, because I said saturated fat, then unsaturated fat. And then I said that you mostly see saturated fat in your animal products. Well, this is a 4-ounce steak, for instance. And I just want you to see that if you look at saturated fat, it's going to have about 9 grams of saturated fat, and it's going to have 89 milligrams of cholesterol, which you can only get cholesterol from animal products. And it has no fiber, and it has no carbs. So people love to eat animal fats because when they're on a very low carb diet. But as I pointed out to you, that it's full of, it has saturated fat in it, which we do not want to be eating. It has saturated fat, which we do not want to be eating. And it has no carbohydrates, which is also not a good thing. But besides that, why else are animal products bad? Well, besides the fact that they have saturated fat and cholesterol, which are both bad in heart disease, if you remember from the trimethylamine mechanism I had shown you early on, where if you eat steak, cheese, and eggs, it increases that trimethylamine N oxide. but it also has excess amounts of heme iron, which has also been associated with atherosclerosis, high amounts of sodium. And if they're processed, you're going to get high amounts of nitrates. You know, from multiple studies that red meat consumption is associated with increased risk of total mortality, CVD, which is heart disease, and cancer mortality. Substitution of other healthy protein sources for red meat is associated with lower mortality risk. We also know that the amount of red meat you take in is the more you take in, the more hazard ratio. So if this is red meat intake on the x-axis and hazard ratio of all-cause mortality, so mortality from any cause, the more meat you eat, the higher your event rate. So what about people who say, I need to get protein? You know, that's why I eat those animal products. Well, people have this misconception in America and really internationally that they are protein deficient. And there are very few people in the entire world that are protein deficient. Maybe if you're starving and you're suffering from starvation, this is a possibility. But 99% of the country or the world is not. Maybe that number is wrong. I don't actually know that number. But most of the world does not have suffer from protein deficiency. But so many people are so focused on animal products as the source of protein because protein makes them strong and have energy. Well, that's actually also true and not true. Most of the time people feel very tired and they start thinking that they need to eat more protein. Well, that's not typically true. And they feel tired because number one, they don't sleep. Number two, they are stressed and have high levels of stress. Number three, they aren't active. And number four, they eat too much sugar. Now, often the sugar is the problem, is where they feel very tired from sugar because they get that high and low that happens when you eat high amounts of refined sugars. But I like this slide in particular because it reminds us that animal products may be high in protein, but there are lots of plant proteins that are very, that are around and also fill you up and give you energy. What's better? Should we eat an animal protein or a plant protein? Well, this on the x-axis favors plant protein on the left side of the uni line or an alternative source or alternate source on the right. And you can see that in terms of heart disease, when you have processed red meat, for sure, that's like bolognese and salamis that you're getting that are processed, and you replace them with a plant protein, you're absolutely decreasing your risk of heart disease. But that's also with unprocessed red meat. So you can see that it stays on the left of the unity line here, that just changing unprocessed red meat to a plant protein, you're decreasing your risk of heart disease. So I think that's really super important. And I also like to point out that even dairy is on there, that if you have dairy as your source of protein and you replace it with a plant protein, you're actually decreasing risk. And also you can see that with poultry, and fish. So fish is right here. So just something to think about. What about eggs? Because eggs is the one thing here on that crosses over to the other side. So didn't necessarily favor shifting over from eggs to plant protein. So what do we know about eggs? Well, this is an article in a really important journal also called JAMA, and it looked at dietary cholesterol or egg consumption and how it's associated with cardiovascular disease or heart disease and mortality. And what they found from that is that for each additional 300 milligrams of dietary cholesterol consumed, it was associated with higher amounts of heart disease. So each additional half egg consumed per day was associated with a higher risk of heart disease and heart events and all-cause mortality. So it's just really important to focus on if you're going to have any animal protein, that maybe eggs is a little bit better than the other choices, but it's not necessarily good. It's not that we should be eating eggs for our health, but maybe if you're going to feel like you need something, it's maybe one of the less bad. So if I'm telling you that all the things you shouldn't eat, that's sort of depressing, right? I just told you that I don't want you to eat saturated fats. I don't want you to eat red meats. I don't want you to eat refined carbohydrates or simple carbohydrates that takes out your sodas and your cookies and crackers. Well, what the heck am I supposed to eat? Well, a whole lot of that. We know that people who eat more vegetarian or vegan actually do better. So non-vegetarian here, semi-vegetarian, pesco-vegetarian, lacto-ovo, that means people who eat milk and eggs, and vegans here on this chart here. And this is body mass index, diabetes, and high blood pressure. And you can see that as you go more plant-based, then you have lower body mass index, lower rates of diabetes, your 0.22 versus 0.72 versus one for the diabetic. So if one is the standard, 0.22 for the vegan, and then look at the blood pressures. Almost a quarter of the risk, three quarters reduction in high blood pressure just by changing your diet. And there's loads of studies that show that eating more plant-based or vegetarian, that if you eat on, so if you're on the left side of this line, then you're more likely you're going to have better blood pressures. One of the biggest studies that looked at that was the DASH diet. And the DASH diet is a diet that is high in fruits and vegetables and low in fat and cholesterol. And this was a study that was done on patients who had high blood pressure, and they put them on a DASH style diet, which didn't have no animal products, but had low amounts of animal products that were all low in fat and cholesterol. And what they found was that if the red line is diet enriched in fruits and vegetables, so the DASH style diet versus the green, which is the more standard American diet, you can see that the blood pressure here, systolic here, that's the top number, and diastolic here, the bottom number, you can see that the blood pressure went significantly down. Here's the red line when people ate more of a DASH style plant-based diet with low fat and low cholesterol. And you can see within 2 weeks, there was a significant drop in blood pressure. Well, what about medications? Well, medications are darn good. I use them all the time. So this shows the impact of the medications on blood pressure. So if you're on the left side of this line, it works. So ACE inhibitors, great medication. I use them all the time. Make your blood pressure go down about 12 millimeters of mercury. Calcium channel blockers, 16 millimeters of mercury. But what if I just cut sodium out of my diet with high blood pressure? Well, I can drop my blood pressure 7 millimeters of mercury. And if I add a DASH style diet and I didn't change my sodium, I can drop my blood pressure 11 millimeters of mercury. Well, what if I use a DASH style diet, which is that high plant-based diet, and I cut the sodium, I can drop my blood pressure 21 millimeters of mercury. Well, that's better than any medication on this list. It's just putting people on a DASH style diet with low salt. There's also a big study called the Lifestyle Heart Study. This is Dean Ornish's study, which he looked at patients who had already had heart disease. And if you already had heart disease, and he put people on a vegetarian, not vegan diet, but low fat again, aerobic exercise, stress management, smoking cessation, just sort of a whole combination of stress, support, love, exercise, movement, and healthy food. And interestingly, because people have a lot of trouble getting people to continue through studies, he was able to keep 35 patients of the 48 through the study. And the reason for that, often people suggest, is because there was so much joy and love in this kind of experience. And what he was able to show, and this is years here on the x-axis and diameter of clogging on the x-axis, you could see that the people who were in the intervention group, so they had the lifestyle intervention, they actually had at least stabilization, if not reduction, in their plaque. But more importantly, if you compare it to the people who were on the standard medications, they actually got worse. Now, there's a lot of criticism of this study, and the reason is because we didn't have the advanced medical therapy that we do now, we didn't have then. And so would these numbers be so far apart if we did the study now? Probably not, but because the medications are so good. But look what you can do with diet. And I think that's the key here, is that you say, what can I do with diet? Well, I can actually prevent progression of my heart disease. And just with adding a dietary intervention on top of medication, boy, you could change your whole life. Is there any room for any animal products? Well, if you look at the Mediterranean diet, which is a very popular diet, so you look at the foundation of the Mediterranean diet, that's fruits and vegetables, grains, whole grains, olive oil, beans and nuts, legumes, seeds, herbs, and spices. That's what the foundation of the Mediterranean diet is. Yes, there's fish and a little bit of poultry and almost no meats and sweets. But if you look at the foundation, it's a plant-based diet. So eating mostly plants and complex carbohydrates is a Mediterranean diet. I think that's important to see. Well, when you are have high risk for heart disease and you go away from a Western diet to a plant-based, a Mediterranean style diet, then you're going to decrease risk. So here's the control diet here. This is event rates on the y-axis, and the x-axis is time. You can see that when you go away from the Western diet and you move towards the Mediterranean diet, either with extra virgin olive oil or with nuts, you're going to decrease your event rate. That shouldn't surprise us, because anything away from that Western diet is going to make us better. But what I really like is this slide, because this is looking at those people who ate Mediterranean style, and the people who adhered to the most vegetarian of the Mediterranean diet actually did the best. So this is mortality rate on the y-axis, and this is the people who adhered to the most vegetarian pattern. Those are the people who had the lowest event rate. This is a Neil Barnard study where he looked at put people who had elevated sugar, and he put them on a plant-based diet versus the American diabetic diet. And he was able to show beyond the American diabetic diet that people lose weight more, their cholesterol fell, their sugars got better just by eating more plants. And this is Essie's study, or Caldwell Esselstyn's study, where he looked at a few patients, but this is in particular one patient who had impact, and not every patient had a heart catheterization, but in this study, he was able to show a significant impact with dietary change. So this is a patient who had an abnormal stress test. So usually the donut, if this was a donut, it should be gold and reddish. And so you can see that the whole donut is not full, and this area here suggests a blockage in the heart arteries. And after 3 weeks of eating a plant-based diet, he was able to show blood flow improved. That's after 3 weeks. And then if you look at the heart catheterization, so when he went inside, or he didn't, but one of the doctors went inside and looked at the heart arteries, they were able to show that there was this ratty looking blood vessel. So this is how a blood vessel should look, nice on the top, which is super pretty. And here it looks kind of ratty and cruddy. But then after repeating the catheterization 32 months later, there was almost complete restoration of flow to that area. And that's in a man who chose not to be on statin medication. So he refused statins, and look at his blood vessel, just emphasizing the benefit of eating more plants. This is a diet that talks about inflammation. So the vegan diet was compared to an American Heart Association diet. And what you can see is that when you are eating American Heart Association diet compared to vegan, the inflammation amounts in the body decrease when you eat more plant-based. So are all plant-based diets good? Should we just tell people eat plant-based? Well, I don't want you to forget that Oreos, Coca-Cola, and potato chips are all vegan. We want people to be eating more whole plants, no refined carbohydrates. Is not the same thing as eating plant-based foods. It's very important. Does it matter though? Like, so what if I just like to eat Lay's potato chips and Oreos and Coca-Cola? So if you look at indices for plants, so people who ate more plant-based, and this is heart disease risk here on the y-axis, and H is healthful plant-based diet. So that healthy, highly complex carbohydrate diet with lots of greens versus unhealthful, which is the gray line. If you hazard ratio of heart events, you wanna be below the zero, which is the line here, that unity line here. So you wanna be below it. And you can see that people who ate the healthful plant-based diet, the H, actually have a reduction in their heart disease events. But the people who ate the U, or unhealthful plant-based diet, they actually have worse events. So remembering that there are many ways to eat unhealthy plant-based foods that can increase your risk. So to remember that we want to stay on the left of the line and not on the right. So how should we advise our patients? Really, I remind people that and people who think eating mostly plant-based or 100% plant-based or whole food plant-based, if they find it too hard, I do like to remind people that we'll take anything. If you shift away from eating a standard American diet, you're going to decrease your risk. So this just shows that eating a Mediterranean style diet, a DASH style diet, just eating more plants is going to decrease your risk of dying. The average American, only about 32% of Americans eat two or more fruits and vegetables per day. 27% eat three or more vegetables per day. And our goal is to eat 5 to 7 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. I like to remind people that a serving of fruits and vegetables is not one or two strawberries, but it's a cup of uncooked vegetables, a half a cup of cooked vegetables, or a baseball sized fruit. This is a study that we did that shows that cardiologists don't do much better. About 29% of cardiologists ate three servings of fruits and vegetables per day. And you can see that only 20% of doctors ate five or more servings of fruits and vegetables per day. So really, I'd like people to remember that it's not really about Mediterranean versus plant-based as much as eating the bottom of the pyramid, which is that we want people to eat mostly plants, almost all plants, and certainly no refined carbohydrates and low in saturated fat. And we really want to have people eat more that's somewhat similar to this, and definitely not looking like this. And to remember that from the DASH study, we know that eating at least five to seven servings of fruits and vegetables does decrease your risk of events. So when I work with people, I often tell people, well, look, if it's too hard to cut out all of your animal products, maybe start with eliminating red meat, then move to chicken, and then move to fish. But certainly you eliminate your red meat first. And I try to get people to remove their dairy and their simple carbs and simple sugars, to processed foods, really adding back in omega-3 fatty acids, lots of fruits and vegetables, complex carbohydrates, and anti-inflammatory spices. Why don't you learn this from your doctors? Well, just like myself, when I was struggling with my own illness and didn't really get any education on how to eat and really didn't know how after whatever 16 or 18 years of training, I still did not have education on how to feed myself or how to feed my community or my patients. It's because we don't learn it. So this is a survey we did where we polled the American College of Cardiology, and only 1% of cardiologists felt that they received a high level of nutrition education that gave them excellent skills for counseling patients. In fact, over 90% felt that they received minimal to no education on how to treat patients or teach people about nutrition. Doctors, these are trainees and doctors at the time of the survey. So what are we doing at the University of Florida? Well, we're working on four areas that I'm focused on: medical education, changing the hospital paradigm, changing the clinic paradigm, and then research. We do a nutrition intensive for our medical students. We have students that come through our and rotate with me in my prevention clinic. We have junior doctors come in and rotate with me. We have a prevention conference, and we do a lot of grand rounds and teaching. In my prevention clinic, we teach people about the healing of lifestyle tools with 1 hour long visits. And now I've shifted this to a telemedicine practice because for many reasons, but I've moved to a telemedicine practice where I get to focus on these 1 hour long visits. But in the past, we've had a yoga room. We focus on meditation and extensive nutrition education. And we were able to collect data on our patients, and we were able to show that people had improved blood pressures, improved cholesterol, they improved their weight, and they just felt better. One of the other things we focused on is we've changed the hospital paradigm, and we have now 100% plant-based menu at the University of Florida. So if you go in with a heart condition, and hopefully you don't, you can ask to eat off of the plant-based menu. So all of the meals here are 100% plant-based. And the other thing that I focus on is research. So I think it's very important to look at what you're doing and how diet works, and then publish, because I think it's very important to tell and show the community in the world that diet matters. We did a culinary medicine workshop as well, where we brought doctors in for a teaching kitchen experience. And this was right before COVID, and we haven't had a chance to do it again, but this was ridiculously popular, and it was so cool to see doctors get excited about nutrition. So really important to sort of teach the next generation of doctors and the current generation of doctors about healthy eating. So this is an exciting time. Hope is in change is possible, and to understand that there's a real connection in what you eat and what happens to the gut, and how what you eat can trigger inflammation and illness. But then also to understand the opposite of that, if what you eat, you can change your gut flora back very quickly. Within weeks, you can see changes in your gut flora, improvement in the short chain fatty acids, and decrease inflammation. And there's so many things you can do then to change your risk of having chronic illness, heart disease, inflammatory disease like myself, So be empowered and know that you can do this and you can be part of the change. And remember that imbalance is equal to inflammation. And so that making sure that you focus on more of your resources than your stresses is very important. So you have two choices. We could perform different bypass surgery where we take a vein out of your thigh and open up your chest so we can sew the vein onto your coronary artery. This costs about $100,000 and will keep you laid up for at least 2 months. Or we could put you on a vegan diet. Well, even though it's not as simple as that, it is fun because it's the man says, a vegan diet, G-Doc, that sounds pretty extreme. So I thought I'd end with a video of what we're doing at the University of Florida and how we changed the menu. And then I just have a few closing remarks.
Hi there. How are you? Monica Ackerman. Nice to see you. Keep them up. Have them in the middle of your morning when you're working, running between patients. It's okay.
So I've been in practice for 10 years, and I would admit that I've given out more Lipitor and Crestor prescriptions than most people because as a cardiologist, that's what we do. What I found that is I kept feeling like I was just giving out more and more medicine, and yet I wasn't making people better somehow. And I also, like many people, feel that, you know, what am I doing here? We as physicians are taught to tell people, well, eat better and exercise more, but we don't really tell people or give doctors the tools so that they can then counsel their patients better. And so what we're trying to do is change that model. I want people starting to realize that even as employees and staff of the hospital, that what you eat matters. The things that you do when you're young impact your whole future. Start changing your habits now and you'll be able to walk better longer. Your joints aren't going to hurt. You're not going to be a 30-year-old with diabetes. You know, all of these things change if you just make the first step now.
So about a year ago, Dr. Agarwal partnered with myself and the food and nutrition team to conceptualize the introduction of a plant-based menu, specifically to start out with our patient population. We have really researched the benefits of introducing plant-based foods into daily cuisine for not even just our cardiac patients, but really our population as a whole and some of the preventative benefits it does have to health. And then what we did was really work very closely, again, with our clinical team, with our culinary team, to design a plant-based menu that really does meet the food preferences of our population here in Gainesville, Florida.
We sat down multiple times throughout the past year, kind of brainstormed, developed different menus, different ideas.
We conducted meal tastings, including our nursing staff, as well as some other staff members in the organization, to get their buy-in and teach our recipes.
You get the dietary staff involved and you get them excited about it, and then you start teaching the nurses about what the food is and letting them taste it, and then they then tell the patient, this is really good. And then the patients start feeling less intimidated and less fear.
Sometimes when they look at the menu and they're a little bit hesitant to try something new, but once they do receive that meal, they're pleasantly surprised with the taste and the flavor of it.
You know, I think that's important to remember that we're not feeding people just lettuce. We're giving people fabulous food. It tastes good. There's different types of flavors.
We do a sweet potato kale hash. We do a lentil bolognese over pasta. We do a tofu vegetable stir fry.
Our next phase is to really start incorporating the plant-based items into our retail operations, such as our cafes, to really promote this same initiative and this same healthful philosophy to our employees and our visitors that come in our door every day.
So let's do this together. Let's not be afraid to make a little bit of a change in your hospital. It takes small steps at the beginning. But I'm confident that we can do it as a group.
You might have some people who might, you know, tilt their head a little bit when they first hear it, but I guarantee if you work through that, and again, if you bring it to them and really engage in the process, it can work. It can work, and it does work, and it really does make a difference.
People often say that it's hard to change. People can't change, and it's just easier to give out a medicine. Boy, I hear that all the time, sometimes every day. I don't agree with that. I think that heart change is hard, but change is good, and that it takes time. But I think that we underestimate sometimes what people are able to do. And so sometimes when you give people the tools, they will make the changes. Not always immediately, but they slowly do. Our job is to just start the process.
Well, thank you so much. So just want to conclude by reminding you a few things that you have the ability to make the changes that you need to feel better. And it doesn't have to be all at once. And you just start with small steps and you will improve every day, just a little bit more. I often tell people to accept what their body has to give and then push it further. Remember that what you do in terms of your genetic risk, you have your genes, which you can't change, but you can change what surrounds the gene. You can change their lifestyle, which then can trigger or decrease inflammation and trigger or decrease illness. Remember that the gut has a large component to this. And so eating is a significant way where you can make changes, but it's not the only thing. Sleep and movement and lack of movement for some people who are overdo it is all important in terms of allowing the body to recover. And that there's so many changes you can make in terms of your diet to improve your gut and then to decrease inflammation and then to decrease your risk of illness. Now, heart disease is not something that you're going to get because your parents had it, that you have the ability to change that. And like me, who has overall told that I had a poor prognosis, incurable, highly damaging form of inflammatory rheumatoid arthritis, and that I would be on medications for the rest of my life, I am proud to tell you that I really am not on medications and have not been on medications in 10 years or 9 years. You have the ability to make these changes too, whether you have inflammatory bowel disease, inflammatory arthritis, heart disease, all of these things. Lifestyle matters and you can make impact. So here's my contact information if you need me. I have a website, drmonicaagarwal.com. What book is called Body on Fire and talks all about inflammation and how the tools we have to fight it. And if you go to my website, I also offer telemedicine and I am also active on social media with my social media prompts listed. Thank you so much again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Agarwal. This was so thorough and so complete and something that so many of us needed to hear. We really, really, really appreciate it. And on a personal note, having seen how hospitals literally around the country have not caught up to the fact that they're feeding people the exact things that are causing the illnesses as to why they're in the hospital in the first place, you're being the change you want to see in the world down there in Florida. And what an impact. What an impact. And I hope everybody follows that around the world. So that said, if it's okay with you, we'll jump into a few extra questions I have for you before we let you go. You've been so gracious already. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Excellent. Thank you. So yeah, just a couple of quick questions. I'm wondering, are there any specific spices that you recommend to really help with lowering inflammation and just for better health in general?
So almost every spice is good. Maybe worry about just eat them. Eat lots of spices, eat them as fresh as can be or newly processed. Really watch because spices do go bad. And so which spices? Well, something people don't realize is that some phytonutrients or plant nutrients that are in existence, you can only get from spices. For instance, turmeric is a highly anti-inflammatory spice that I always call, people know that I call this Monica's gold. So I truly feel that turmeric is my gold and it is an anti-inflammatory spice that I eat regularly and has been really helpful for me. I don't want people to then say, okay, well, Agarwal said I should take turmeric. I'm going to throw it into everything. Well, it can have like anything. It can be in excess, can cause reflux or heartburn, it can cause liver damage. So everything in excess can be a problem, but a healthy use of spices like turmeric for inflammation, cumin or cumin powders, mango powder, pomegranate powder is really good, or pomegranate for dilation of blood vessels. Garlic is really good for as an antibacterial. Ginger is really good as an anti-nausea. I mean, these are all sort of spices that we should be eating on a daily basis. So I often tell people, just pull out all of your spices and put them next to your stove and look at them. Rosemary is another one I forgot to mention, a hugely important one because of the anti-cancer effects. People even, I don't know if I believe the studies, but I like it because it said if you smell rosemary, just smelling it can decrease the cortisol levels. That's your stress level. I probably say that about every spice. Like if you smell basil, I don't know, I feel like I'm in heaven. But basil, another super good spice to be using. So as many spices as you can do, just line them up on your kitchen counter and then try to think about, I'm going to make this today. Like, what am I going to add to it? And so I think I've seen in a more traditional American diet that spices are not as, people aren't as comfortable. And that's an overgeneralization, and not everybody's like this, but people often use salt and pepper as a more common, these are my spices. But I think that figuring out how to use these other spices that may be more traditionally Eastern or European or Mediterranean will help you cut out some of that salt in particular that people are using to sort of make their food taste better. I mean, there's so many things you can do, even pepper. I mean, pepper is such a great spice that has, can actually, like for instance, we actually have a substance now where we actually take pepper and we put it on joints because it helps decrease pain. So imagine what you could do if you put it in your body.
Thank you very much for that. And I guess my next question is I'm wondering if you can expand on, aside from food, what are the most important things that everyone should be doing to prevent against getting any disease?
You know, sleep is super important. People forget that the average adult should sleep 7 to 9 hours a night. Most people don't. Most people sleep 5 or 6 and say, oh, I can handle it. It eventually catches up to you. My husband is one of those people who insists that he can sleep on 5 or 6 hours and does just fine. But there's loads of mortality data that people who sleep less actually do worse. So sleep and then movement is really important. Most people suffer from lack of movement and are sedentary and really moving. Even just walking 2,000 steps will decrease your risk of an event. 2,000 extra steps a day can change your life. So just starting with something very simple, like going, okay, I'm going to walk for 5 minutes. Yes. Will that do anything? That's not going to do anything. What are you talking about? Absolutely. Studies show that even walking an extra 5 minutes a day will improve your life. So, but also tell people, because we have such a community of high achieving, intense people. People like to call them type A personalities, which I may or may not be one, who continue to always do. And to remind those people like myself or not myself who it's important to also stop and allow yourself time that, you know, going out and going for a run after having a really long day and trying to do an extra couple miles, that's not also a good thing. You need to allow your body time to recover.
Got it. Thank you for that. I'm wondering, what does the science say about plant oils like hemp and flax, olive and chia oil, for example?
The oil data is super unclear right now. It's always been unclear. We just don't have a load of data. We know that oils in general, like coconut oil, for instance, is over 90% saturated fat. So that's not an oil that we recommend as physicians, although a lot of people like to use it. I don't recommend it, and we don't as a society recommend it. So I always tell people, use it in your hair. It's really good in your hair. It's really good for dry skin, but it's not necessarily something you want to put in your body. The other plant oils, which is, you know, olive oil and avocado oil and so many others, you know, they are highly concentrated fats. And so there are some studies in animals that show that no matter what oil you use, it causes plaque in your heart. But there's a lot of data, of course, on olive oil that shows that it has all this high polyphenol content, which is anti-inflammatory. And so the answer is that we don't really know if a little bit, we know that a lot of oil is not a good thing, but we don't really know if a little bit of oil is a bad thing. We just don't know. I'm doing a great study. I'm really proud of it at the University of Florida right now, where I'm looking at people, or I'm putting people who are on 100% plant-based that are on a Western diet. I'm shifting them to 100% plant-based diet. And then I'm giving them high oil similar to a Mediterranean diet, and then a low oil. So I'm crossing it over 4 weeks on one and 4 weeks on another. And I want to see, does the oil actually make a darn bit of difference? Like, I don't know that we know the answer to that question. And actually, this will be one of the first studies to actually look at that from the beginning to the end to understand that question.
Thank you for doing that on behalf of all of us. And actually, I guess I have a follow-up to that. And I know that you mentioned that there are obviously some fats in avocados and so on, but ultimately, you know, do you recommend that we eat or avoid these whole plant fats, such as raw nuts, raw seeds, avocados, and raw olives versus the oils themselves?
It depends. Well, the whole plant is always better than the oil, right? The oils are just this concentrated form of the fat. Whereas if you eat an avocado, you're getting all the nutrients and the vitamins and you're getting the fibers. So that's a whole different game. So you should always eat the whole plant if you're going to choose it for anything. It should always be the whole food. Should we eat those kind of foods at all? Well, it depends on the person. In general, most people that are eating a wholesome, whole food, plant-based diet that are getting fats from oils, from avocados, nuts and seeds, that's a good thing. They're going to need it. It's going to make them feel full and it's going to be good for their bodies. But there are people that I've had to restrict that are very high cholesterols or have very advanced heart disease that I have to restrict those foods for a while until I can heal them and then that we can work together and heal their bodies. And then sometimes I can reintroduce. But some people have such advanced heart disease that I do restrict them. So it really depends on the case.
Got it. Thank you. I guess I have one last question for you. And that is, this is sort of a broad question, but what are you telling women specifically versus men, and just in terms of staying healthy? What maybe there's some information that mainstream doctors are out there telling women that you disagree with. Just want to give you that opportunity to share.
Is there something in particular that you were concerned about?
I guess within your specialties, so whether that's heart disease or RA for that matter. Just wondering if there's something specific for women that you want to share here.
So, heart disease is the number one killer of women. People forget that. They often focus on breast cancer which is not to say that breast cancer isn't horrible or doesn't a horrible process to have to go through. But women are actually dying of heart disease. They're not dying as much of breast cancer. So the number one cause of death in America of women is heart disease. So, women ignore their bodies more because they are the breadwinners, or not the breadwinners, they're the homemakers. They take care of the families, they make all the food, and it's, I'll take care of myself later and focus on the rest of the family. So if they have symptoms, they go to the hospital later. They live at home with symptoms longer. In fact, when they go to the ER, they're ignored more because their symptoms are not because doctors are bad, but because their symptoms are more atypical. Women have more atypical heart disease symptoms. So if you have a symptom that's weird, you need to honor yourself enough to listen to your body, ask somebody what it is, don't ignore it, don't let anybody downplay it, and just tell the docs, something's not right. And they are required and obligated to help you figure out what it is. So that would be something that I would say, and that, just don't ignore yourself. I have three kids, I have a full-time job. I have an active, my mother-in-law lives in town and we take care of her. And we have a lot of family. I got two dogs, I got 40,000 bees. And so we have a lot going on. And so very often the person that gets neglected the most is me. And I have to remind myself that it's okay to nap. I'm proud that I love to nap. It's okay to take time for yourself. And you need to, that hashtag self-care is one of the things that I really like to say, which is just, it's okay to take care of yourself. Allow yourself that time.
I love hearing that from you. And thank you so much for that. Thank you for spending a little extra time with us and answering these questions. And again, for just an amazing, amazing lecture and presentation, and for all the work you're doing, we really, on behalf of our entire audience, we're very, very grateful and filled with gratitude. So thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing you again.
My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you. Be well.